This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We've got Electric Violin with Marta Richardson, a little bookstore that could with Scuppernong Books owner Brian Lampkin, and a few little weekend arts picks bonus tracks from the Triad Arts team. But first, Bethany Chafin kicks things off with the Ella Zoo.
Last month, Bibby Coyne released the Ella Zoo, and out came the caterpillar, the koala bear, a giraffe, gazella, and many more. Bibby's fun and heartwarming poetry collection captures the energy and character of her own animal-loving daughter, Ella. The collection depicts a daughter's journey through childhood and a parent's own amazing and loving observations. The poems will engage readers of all ages, as will Valentina Felce's expressive illustrations. Bibby has worked primarily as an art director for most of her career, and you might recognize her as the proprietor of Studio Supplies, a business venture for which she won the Winston-Salem Small Business Plan competition a few years ago. The Ella Zoo is Bibby's first published book of poetry. Her daughter Ella is a freshman at R.J. Reynolds, and animals are only one of many interests, including dance, music, and visual arts. Bibby and Ella joined me in the studio at WFDD to discuss the Ella Zoo, and Bibby began by describing just how meaningful this collection is.
It's a love story, and it's about this strange love affair you have with your children. You meet them, and you don't know who they are, and you fall in love instantly. It's unlike a love story that you would hear in a typical poem, and they come into being over time, and every moment is miraculous in its own way. I get all emotional.
That's absolutely fine. It's a beautiful collection of poems inspired by and dedicated to Ella, your daughter.
Yes.
Ella, can you say hi?
Hi.
We're so glad that you could come be with us today. This is obviously a project that encompasses a whole childhood and, as you said, the love of a parent for their child. And so I'm wondering if these poems were written throughout the course of that childhood, or were they written in kind of a more distinct time period as you're looking back, maybe?
It definitely evolved. It started with a nickname. We called her Ella Roo because she jumped all over the place. Ella Roo and Papu. She had a little lovey, this little dog toy that I had to protect as much as her. And he's in the book too, by the way. He's on every spread that she is because that's the way they were. She's an animal lover. She has been a girl that loves animals her whole life from the beginning. She never was attracted to dolls, only to animal toys. And she had little animal characteristics. She would wag her tail or act like an animal. So Ellery was the beginning. She could walk early. She could climb even quicker. She had this willful nature that was amazing and startling. It's a whole evolution for a parent, too. A childhood is something the parent goes through. And I started to write these little poems, and they evolved. And in 2008 is when I decided this could be a collection of poems. And I brainstormed what animal names we could turn her name into, like Ella Roo, and decided Giraffe was a name. And I kind of started with a list and wrote a few poems about the beginning. I kept having to set it down at times when life got busy, but then I would pick it up again and write a few more and realize I had a whole new understanding of who Ella was, and the poetry changed. And when I came back to it and wrote a couple more poems, I realized that one of the key features of the book was this aging process, that it was love over time, which is one of the reasons I chose John Anderson, My Joe, as a inspirational poem, because that's a poem about love over time, how it changes. And I knew then I would have to start over on the illustrations, unfortunately, and have her grow and age through the illustrations and the poetry, and that the sequence would be chronological. It also shaped the end poem, that in the end, I wanted it to be a statement about her, simply her, as a girl. The Nightingale. We've had dinner. It's not yet late. Time for coffee. The guests brought cake. We grow contentedly slack on the sofa. Is it the sound of an audience hushed, or a darkened house that cues the elegance, the wings, the quiet overture when then our Nightingale sings. The last couple of poems really get me, touch me very deeply, because there comes a point when your baby who's been clinging to you is independent. It's not necessarily easy for a mom, and you're proud at all the same time. It's a complex feeling, and a little sad, actually. And she became this strong, amazing girl, and I wanted to celebrate that as much as I want to say, man, I'm going to miss you as you grow to college and things like that.
You still got 3 years.
I know. So it was definitely an evolution. It took about 6 years. Wow. All in all.
So Ella, thanks again. Thanks for coming in. And first of all, one question. Did your mom or dad read poetry to you as a child? Did you kind of grow up hearing, you know, written word in some ways?
My mom and my dad were more of influenced by art history. So they made me read this one book on different artists and how their styles vary. So that's what I'm used to reading. And as my mom said, I am more of an animal person. So I read a lot of animal books, and like my favorite childhood book was a James Herriot book. And now I actually got like the full story of it that I'm reading, and I'm really loving it.
So Papu is a character in this collection, and tell me a little bit about Papu.
One of the stories about him that I really remember was when we were in Maine and we were on a camping trip and I brought him. I lost him at a lobster restaurant. We had this like big FBI search for Papu, and Mom even drew a picture of him for reference. And one day they shipped him back and he was underneath the pier, I think. And I was just like crying, and I was like with joy, and I just went to bed immediately and just cuddled with him.
So Ella, did you know that he would feature so prominently in this collection?
Nope.
That's kind of a surprise?
This whole thing is a surprise to me because I'm very independent and I kind of do my own little thing up in my room, which kind of resembles to one of the poems in here. And it's like I'm away from everything else, but I kind of have my thing. I'm like drawing on my desk or I'm watching Mythbusters. So I'm just like walking downstairs for a snack, and then I realize you're writing a book about me. Okay. And it just evolves, and I'm so happy for my mom for doing this, and I'm just really proud of her.
Oh, that's wonderful. Which poems do you really like in this collection?
Gazella is my favorite because playing all of the different sports that I did in my childhood is really prominent in this poem, and sports are a fourth of my entire life because there's arts, science, sports, and animals.
Great. Will you read that poem for us?
Sure. I don't think it will be as good as my mom can read it, but I'll try.
That'll be great.
The Gazella. On the grass in the bright sun, see my gazella run. Leaps off the bus when day is done, see my gazella run. With antelope legs, long, lean, she takes chase gleefully, or challenges all to a race, and sprints to the next tree. On the fields in uniform, see my gazella run. Stripes adorn the herd's sleek form, see my gazella run. A soccer ball is involved, but the game's chase, that's all. A pride of parents stands aside. Pick out their one with trained eyes. See my gazella run.
What was your reaction to seeing the final product?
One of my dad's students, she did the illustrations, and I fell in love with those because they resemble to things that actually happened in my childhood. Like one of them is where there are like sticky notes on my door, and I actually put sticky notes on my door that says stay away, or high ground equals less, low ground equals no, and growl means go away. That's like my morning thing, like
it's your language. So she captured you well, you thought.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought those illustrations were beautiful and amazing. And Bibby, for the listener who might not have the book in front of them, could you describe, her name's Valentina, could you describe her style for us?
Valentina has a beautiful, whimsical, lovely, charming style. To sort of describe it based on other illustrators I know well, it reminds me a little bit of Edward Gorey, but sweeter. A little Shel Silverstein, but younger. There's a lot that I'm reminded of, but they are entirely her own, too. It's very much a well-developed style. Valentina, as Ella mentioned, was a student of my husband, and my husband teaches at School of the Arts. When she was still in Winston is when I began this process with her, and explained at the time that I wanted to capture something of Ella, you know, but have it be every girl, too. And I shared with her pictures of Ella's doors, things I liked, Ella's papu, Ella's doors, Ella as a baby, even though we weren't necessarily going to try to make it look like her. I wanted to capture that essence of a young girl growing up. And we had gotten halfway through the illustrations, and at that point there were three poems that weren't written, actually, but we got halfway through where we were, and then I said, you know what, we need to have her age visibly. And that's when Papu came into the picture. And it's a little bit of a risk to have a character that looks different on every page and for you to understand that it's the same character. I wanted to make sure there was a thread that united this so you would know this is the same girl. And so he's there for that reason. And also as a game for a very young child. One of the difficult things about this book, and that I was adamant about when I had approached publishers, is they mentioned that the vocabulary is at time older for a child. I was very strong in my opinion that I have never seen a child shy away from a multisyllabic word if it was something they felt they could understand, if it was in the right context. They were proud to understand big words. The other thing that I think will engage any young child is that the mother or the father reading this to them is going to have an emotional reaction to the piece. It's going to, I think, connect to their parenting experience. And that should warm up their voice, which the child, of course, will definitely respond to. But there's other things for an older child. The different poetic forms are something to explore, too. And then the illustrations.
Like you said, that there are different forms of poetry used, that obviously that's appropriate because there are different forms of a childhood and phases that are being expressed, so it works really well together. And also something else I thought was really thoughtful, back to Valentina for a second, was that the shadow of each animal that you're expressing or that you're relating to is expressed through her illustration behind the character.
It was really creative. It kind of evolved, too. The shadow, she added to one illustration. I was like, oh, Valentina, that's fantastic. Let's do that again. Valentina actually suggested that I write Snella because she had an idea for illustration. And I'm like, okay, I think I can do that. Ella's certainly slow enough in the morning. I could definitely get some inspiration. I wrote it, and then I thought, I want to try another poetic form. And I'd never heard of a rondo. I actually found it searching poetic forms, and I'd never written one, certainly. I rewrote the poem to put it into the poetic form, and I think the form was so inspiring and so appropriate to Snail and so appropriate in the sequence, how something curls back in on itself. And sometimes form, a restriction, can really inspire you to find those things that are really important. And it did. Ella, dear, it is time to go. We've a long list of things to do, and you have a lesson today. Let's stop by the store on the way. We need to hurry out the door. Ella, dear, you are quick as rust. Bring your brush with if you must. Do you realize how slow you are? Ella, dear, it is time. Every day her pace seems so slow, pushing years, then one day I know I don't want her to leave so fast. And when I try to hold her back, the keys, Mom, you need to let go. Ella, oh dear, it is time. And it's amazing, I think, anytime you journal or you write something, it's amazing to see that these moments, they were moments that became a treasured memory, that are what are staying with her. She's in chorus now. She's still singing, and she is still playing sports. And the things that are important to her, was they were easy to see, easy to recognize, and they really did connect with me. So, and in many ways, Ella wrote them too, because she's who I started with, you know. The chinchilla. How I long to stroke her soft fur, in my lap allow her to curl, instead of the lonely burrow of her room where she roams at night, where to her music she delights, primping and preening out of sight. Though inquisitive as ever, and with her friends always clever, it is family she has severed from her daily habitation. With territorial limitations, here she's facing near extinction. Though occasionally she'll let me in to stroke her head as nightly I once did to a lullaby, the tune still ringing in my breast, silently I lull her to rest so I can this rare creature pet and adore her. How lovely and soft is my chinchilla.
Bibby and Ella Coyne. Bibby is the author of The Ella Zoo. Her book is a product of Studio and is sold through studiodesign.com, amazon.com, and other online book distributors. Bibby will be reading from The Ella Zoo at Twin City Hive on Saturday, January 31st. The event runs from 2 to 3:30 p.m., and it will include an art activity and book signing. All ages are welcome. Illustrator Valentina Felse will be there as well. For more information, visit our website at wfdd.org, and once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. Bethany Chafin returns on the second half of the show with a stirring tribute to the power of books to bring people together and strengthen our community. She'll have Scuppernong Books owner Brian Lampkin in the studio for an up-close and personal look at all that a bookstore can be and a season preview of what's coming up at Scuppernong this year. For years, violinist and educator Marta Richardson longed to record her own CD, but full-time work and family obligations forced her to put those dreams on hold. Then, a series of events gave her a new sense of purpose. First, a close friend and fan of Marta's work, who had always encouraged her to document her sound, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. So Marta took a renewed sense of urgency into the recording studio. Then, shortly after beginning the project, she came across the poetry of 16th century mystic St. John of the Cross. After reading just 2 stanzas and the remarkable imagery she found there, she instantly realized her recording would be a concept album based on his poetry. The new CD is titled Mystic Canticle, a Meditation. We're sampling from it right now, and Marta joined me recently to talk about the project. Some people feel the need to compose, others don't. Talk about that need you felt then to document your work.
Oh, that's the word. I really feel like every artist needs to intentionalize towards documenting their work. I think a lot of times as classically trained musicians, especially violinists, we're seeing ourselves as like the soldiers of the orchestra. We do what we're told when we're told to do it. I've had several opportunities over the years to play spontaneously and to capture the direction of the music and just go in for it. And so often, those are just fleeting moments. And you think, that was really beautiful, and I'll never hear that again. And so I wanted to capture that.
That's part of your style, this improvisational approach to your recording. What are the upsides and downsides of that? I mean, you kind of alluded to maybe a possible downside. It's gone. It's in the ether.
It's gone. I mean, there's just been these divine moments almost. I mean, I remember one time playing in the band Songs of Water, where we were playing at a venue, and we just took off into this direction, and it went on for quite a while. And then all of a sudden, there was just this hush. I mean, this was a bar with people smoking and drinking, and suddenly everybody knew that something almost sacred had happened. And those are wonderful things, to have that kind of spontaneity. But it is nice to capture it. And that's what this project was all about.
And you used the word divine. How does St. John of the Cross factor into this project?
Well, I had already gone into the studio, and we had laid down 2 tracks, and we gave them some names. And I just thought, I don't know. I mean, they're okay, but that's not speaking to me. And about a few weeks later, my husband and I were in Mount Airy at an antique bookstore, and I came across the writings of St. John of the Cross, and I was like, I kind of remember this. I remember liking it. It's hard to find his work. And I opened up the book, and turn to these two stanzas, and right there, I just felt like I had practically the entire project. And then I remembered, you know, I read more about him and realized that, you know, this man wrote this poetry while he was imprisoned. He was suffering, and yet he wrote this most beautiful, beautiful poetry.
He was a 16th century Spanish mystic. What is a mystic?
A mystic are known for having experiences that not always the church understands. They have very intimate experiences with God. Sometimes they'll see visions. This is interesting. This was Counter-Reformation time where the church was really going through a lot of turmoil. And they were these people that just had these hearts. They were just dedicated to seeking out God. And he wrote this poetry that actually comes out of the Song of Solomon. But at that time, if you translated scripture into the vernacular, it could mean your life.
Mm-hmm. And now you turned a couple of his stanzas, you know, talking about this imagery that was so rich for you. And then right away, you say you knew that you had a concept album on your hand. What was that process like?
It's really hard to describe. One of those two tracks we call The Voyage. It has the sound of a ship creaking, and it's like, wow, this is a really interesting piece. But I knew it wasn't called The Voyage. And when I got to the part of the poetry that said The Strange Islands, I thought, oh, wait a minute. This is The Strange Islands. But all these things can take different meanings. For instance, in my mind, Strange Islands meant, you know, this old ship coming up to this island, and it has no idea whether it's, you know, full of treasure or dangerous. I was playing it for my students, though, and I got suddenly convicted because a ship that creaked like that with the students. I work with a diverse population. I was suddenly convicted because this was not a ship probably going for treasure. This was probably carrying people, you know, as slaves. So even though I found the music connected to the poetry, someone else can have a totally different experience. I love the idea of a person's sound affecting a person's soul. And so when you're capturing that sound, hopefully you're either, you know, bringing some sort of healing or some sort of encouragement to that person.
You've created this wonderful concept album, beginning with Mountains, the first track on the CD, and it's a nice long intro with this very mysterious atmospheric sounds I'm hearing. Mm. Tom Buchanan did the programming work for you on this album. What was it like working with Tom in the studio, and maybe what did you learn along the way?
When we started to do Mountains, Tom really carried that track. I mean, he came in that day and he said, do this, do this, do that. And I was like, where is this going? And then I watched him for the next 2 hours, 3 hours, put it all together. It was a real privilege to watch someone of that caliber create that sound.
One of the things I really enjoy about this particular track was the time you take with the introduction. And then I guess it's just knowing when the melody emerges out of that.
And we had to work at that. When we did it, we listened to it and realized we actually had to cut some of the building into it process a little bit out of it. It was too long. But the whole idea is you're trying to almost woo people into your sound and woo them into this project so that you want them to be drawn into it. So hopefully that's what we accomplished with that piece. Mm-hmm.
Solitary Wooded Valleys, the following track, and I enjoy the variety of sounds and textures on this album in general. You go from the lush orchestration and percussion of Mountains to simple keyboard and violin solo here. Tell me about this piece.
It's very serene, and when I listen to it, I think the poetry itself is full of imagery, so if I can get my brain around that, I'm trying to get a sound to go with that. And for me, that piece captured just the serenity, if you can imagine yourself walking through the woods all by yourself. And it's a long piece, too. It's not short. You're going to take a real journey through these woods and just be with nature and experience that feeling, hopefully.
besides the extra string, talk about the 5-string electric violin. Is it any different playing that than regular violin?
It is different. I do have some neck issues, so I had to kind of reinvent myself as a musician, as a violinist. And there's this wonderful shop in Durham called the Electric Violin Shop. I tried out every single violin, and I fell in love with the one behind the glass door. And actually, the Regional Artist Grant years ago helped pay for that instrument, too. I love that instrument. And it is, electric is totally different. It doesn't require the strength of, you know, bearing down and making your sound come out of the acoustic. It's a lighter touch. Of course, it has that fifth string to settle all that viola envy that I've suffered from for all these years in orchestra playing.
So the fifth string is the lower string?
It's the C.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. There you go.
So it allows you just to go into a and you'll hear it. It's like, wow, where did that sound come from? Because it's not what you're expecting from a violin.
That's right. That's some of the beautiful. Did you begin on that string in the was it mountains?
Probably.
Yeah. It starts as this beautiful. So I'm wondering what that.
Actually, we did that with the special effects where we dropped my sound down an octave, so it's even lower than the C string.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about Sonorous Rivers? The big shift of gears here to guitar and a nice folkish flavor to this. The sound of water returns, though. Why is that sound important to you?
The Sonorous Rivers is a different, it takes on a whole different flavor. It's a much earthier kind of sound. We brought in Keith Miller, who's a wonderful bassist, lives in Greensboro. He got his doctorate at UNCG a few years back. Brought in a percussionist and let this one just sonorous. We really wanted to just expand the sound and explore. Even though it's a little bit more traditional and kind of Appalachian sounding, we tried to stretch the sound out to make it sonorous.
And we talked a little bit about Whisper of the Amorous Breezes. Very evocative title, by the way.
Yes, it is.
I'm not familiar with with St. John of the Cross. Is that directly inspired by his writings, that title?
Actually, yeah. Talk about evocative. The poetry, I was kind of haughty when I first read the poetry. It has lots of commentary, and I thought, oh, I don't need to read the commentary. I can receive what I like out of this poetry. And then one day in the studio, I was waiting for Tom to come off the phone, and I started reading the commentary, and it was so intimate, and at times almost explicit. Of course, it's based on the Song of Solomon, which we know is pretty intimate in itself. We wanted to capture this amorous breeze, and I thought that was the perfect place to bring Kathy Martinson in and use her vocals.
She sings a beautiful song without words. Tell me about Kathy.
Kathy is just a very gifted vocalist. I met her at church. Being classically trained, we don't always, in a more contemporary church setting, don't always have a place for a voice like that. But I see that happening more and more. We're going to start blending these different cultures together, African-American church, traditional church, contemporary modern church. There should be room for everybody and for everyone's sound. So when we see somebody like Kathy in our church, I feel like, personally, we should find a way for her to come forth and not just try to fit a formula of what we think. You know, we needed this and a this and a this and a this for the service, but hey, look over there. There's a gifted artist. Let's make a way for her to come forth.
Violinist and educator Marta Richardson. Her new album is Mystic Canticle, A Meditation. We've been sampling from the recording, and you'll find links to the CD at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can catch Marta live in the beautiful and intimate surroundings of Seacrest Art Gallery at High Point University next weekend. She'll be performing works from the new album for her friend, artist and collaborator Maria Sultan, February 6th from 4 to 6 o'clock. The exhibit, Elemental Emulsions, Maria Sultan Paintings, Meet and Greet with Maria Sultan, and Maria's Artist Talk are free and open to the public. You'll find more information on our website. Again, it's WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And you can hear my interview with Maria on Monday morning, February 2nd at 8:45 during Triad Arts. I'm David Ford. and associate producer Bethany Chafin will take it from here.
The function of a bookstore is pretty straightforward. Provide the reader with a book they seek. The reality is that an independent bookstore often transcends this definition, and that's certainly the case with Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. The bookstore has become an intellectual and cultural hub, and in the past year, it's hosted 155 readings by local and nationally renowned writers, 191 book clubs or community meetings, 24 music events, and 13 art events. Brian Lamkin is the owner of Scuppernong, and in a recent letter he wrote, "We believe that books and independent bookstores matter to people's lives. Sometimes they even change lives." Brian joined me to elaborate on these sentiments. So you're not unfamiliar to this industry. You've been involved with several bookstores, if I understand correctly. Tell me a little bit about maybe the first one you worked in, and then it's Rust Belt Books, right?
Well, that was the first one I started on my own. Yeah. So Rust Belt Books in Buffalo, New York, and boy, just a real joy, you know. I had the store for 12 years, and it became, I think, like a real cultural center of Buffalo. You know, we did so many fun and interesting things with that store. And that's where I sort of developed a sense of, you know, a bookstore is not just about books by any means. It's about so much more about what kind of art and culture and excitement you can bring to a downtown. Certainly. And I think we had that.
So what did you take from that experience? Obviously, the fact that a bookstore is goes beyond its shelves. Did you bring into Scuppernong, into this project?
Yeah, so I wanted to make it a community center, right? I wanted it to be a place that really mattered to Greensboro on many levels. You know, an independent bookstore needs to be like an intellectual core of a city. Like, I can't go to a city without an independent bookstore and be happy, right? I need that sort of centering core. And for me, a really good independent bookstore does that, you know, especially one located right downtown. You know, it brings people together. It brings ideas together. It's a place where ideas are bantered, you know, where disagreement can happen respectfully. I think there's something about a bookstore space that makes that possible.
Certainly. So you talk about a bookstore bringing people together. Obviously, there are probably a lot of people who came together at the outset of this vision and project. Who were some of those people, and how did they sort of help Scuppernong become what it is today?
Yeah, I think one important thing to say is this all would not have happened without the enthusiasm of Greg Grieve, who was my initial partner in this. It was his idea, really. You know, he knew I had a bookstore in Buffalo and just, you know, on a lark said, "Hey, how about we open one here?" And I'm at the place where, I've done it. I can't do it again. But you just take that initial little step forward, you know. Well, let's just go look at spaces, you know, and or whatever it might be. And suddenly you're on this path. You can't ignore the train, right? You know, it's going to drag you along. And pretty soon I was completely immersed. Greg's a religious studies professor at UNCG and has returned rightfully to his life there. But without him, it wouldn't have happened.
Okay, well, let's talk about the physical space. How did you come about where you are now? You're on South Elm, and it used to be a record store, is that right?
Yeah, in the 80s, I'm told. It was a really quite rockin' record store. On the wall, there were still posters from the 80s. Right? There was a Neil Young poster from an album I know came out in the 80s. And also, there were these great shadows on the wall of where records used to be.
Really?
So you would just, it's like ghostly, right? There'd be these shadows of the past on the wall.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we walked in the door, though, and it was completely dilapidated space. Mm-hmm. But you could see a beautiful bookstore right away, or at least I felt like I could. So we're so grateful to Nancy Hoffman, who's the owner of the building, and the work she's done to really save a space.
So for someone who hasn't been there, could you maybe tell us, you know, what you see when you walk in and how it's laid out? Just briefly.
Yeah. It's a long, narrow space, sort of a classic Greensboro space that way. But you walk in the front door and you have a sight line all the way to the back, right? And it's, you know, the old windows and this beautiful lights and the high ceilings and the exposed brick and, the old floors. You just, I've seen people walk in the door and just say, wow. You know, it's like, it's not the wow of excess. It's the wow of comfort, of something recaptured.
Something I really like as far as the aesthetic layout is, your windows up front, you know, where you'd normally expect to see maybe a mannequin displaying wares. I mean, what you all have done is brilliant, because instead there are, you know, several tables, and what you are able to promote and publicize is exactly what happens inside, which is someone engaging with a book, usually sitting
right,
there
right.
and enjoying themselves.
Right.
So that speaks for itself.
Yeah. And it's obviously the favorite part of the store. You know, people yeah. want those seats in the front window.
Yeah.
You know, because you're looking out on the world and the world's looking out on you, I guess. And yeah, so thanks. That's a really nice piece of the store. Yeah.
I do like that. Okay. So imagine you've got all your bookshelves set up. You haven't put all the books on them yet. How do you begin to supply a store like that? Because I'll tell you a little something. I have a friend who judges an independent bookstore by whether or not it has a very meaningful book to her. And you passed the test with flying colors. I think she even looked for several and found all of them and immediately knew that this was going to be one of her happy places. Right. How do you be selective about that but offer something universal?
Yeah, and that's, I think, the real trick. And you got to create a lot of happy places for a lot of different people, right? Which requires, I think, the most important thing for a bookseller is curiosity about a lot of different things. You have to know about a lot, and you have to be interested in a lot. You can't fake it, right? You gotta know your stuff. And obviously, you can't read everything, but you're paying attention all the time, you know? We're a literary bookstore, right? So we have this amazing input about literature and poetry that you won't find in many other places. You know, the people who work at Scuppernong really know their stuff, man. You know, they know a lot about books. They know a lot about the history of ideas. You know, we're not experts on anything, I would guess. But I'll give you this line, you know, that my daughter has always said about me. You know, Dad, you don't know very much about quite a lot. You know, and that's exactly right. I think that's the place I need to be comfortable.
About some of the great events that you all have held over the past year. What are some of your favorites and why?
Like, we had this Wordsomnia event, probably my favorite event of the year, which was a 24-hour reading. So from 6 p.m. on Friday to 6 p.m. on Saturday, we had a constant reading going on. 120 writers over that 24-hour period, everyone with a 10-minute block. And, you know, Steve Mitchell and I, Steve runs the kitchen side of things, but is also a writer in his own right and a part owner of the store. So we stayed awake all 24 hours, and it was just an incredible event. You know, when dawn came at whatever time it was, 6:55 in the morning, whatever, we all went outside and read Footnote to Howl to the dawn, you know. So a space grants you this freedom to do things with it, right? To have this beautiful space in this great part of downtown Greensboro is both a responsibility to use it in fun and interesting ways and gives us a freedom to do kind of interesting things. Another great event was our Banned Books Day, where we basically stood on a soapbox outside the store and read banned books, you know, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Just everyone was invited to read their favorite banned book. So out to the masses of Greensboro, we would read some, you know, whatever book, Handmaid's Tale. I started off with Handmaid's Tale, and we went on through the whole litany of great American literature that's been banned. But it led to some awkward moments, too, because sometimes books are banned for particular reasons. And right. So we're reading passages, you know, out in public that, you know, were a bit challenging, but still just a really important and great event, you know, to highlight this ongoing struggle with censorship. So many great writers have come to the store. And I think our relationship with writers is important and gratifying. You know, writers want independent bookstores because independent bookstores sell their books. You know, the big stacks of million sellers you might see at a box bookstore aren't at our store, you know. What we're selling more is our writers who are missed by the mass culture. But we know those books are amazing, right? We've read those books. And so the writers just so appreciate the fact that we're there. So we get so much support from both local writers, you know, Fred Chappell, Michael Parker, Lee Smith, whoever has come to the store. But we also have got a fair number of really pretty great writers, like National Book Award winner Jacqueline Woodson was at the store just before she won her award. Natalie Goldberg was at the store. Wiley Cash. The great Bill Morris, whose book I love, Motor City Burning.
how do you grow from here? Have your goals for the second year changed from your goals for the first? Was first, not to be blunt, was first about survival in some ways? Or was that a concern at all?
Oh, always. Yeah. You know, we want to survive. People want us to survive. People want us to make good economic decisions, right? I'm over my panic about survival. You know, it's working. You know, we know it works. We do have to fine-tune it to, you know, to stay alive and to make sure we're taking care of the people who work there in responsible ways, like, you know, health insurance and paying people decently.
Right.
That's not an easy thing for an independent bookstore to manage, mm-hmm. but it's obviously a goal we have, right? You got to live the values you preach, right?
Mm-hmm. Are there any big allies to the independent bookstore that you might not expect? Like, everybody hears about kind of the foe of the independent bookstore, but what are the forces working to help keep the independent bookstore thriving?
You know, the people around us want us to succeed. You know, all the downtown businesses, you know, very supportive. They really appreciate what we've brought to downtown, right? And vice versa. Libraries, strangely enough, like you might think of libraries and bookstores as somehow being in opposition. Not the case at all. You know, it's about love of books, right? It's about a librarian walks in the door, we practically all cheer, you know, because, you know, we know this is a person we're really going to engage in this conversation with. They buy books. They're just lovely people, right? Who doesn't love a librarian? We have a wine bar in the store. You know, we have coffee and wine and beer and food. And, you know, that it's so complicated, right? It makes my life really challenging because you're running several different businesses at once in some ways. But without that, it's a completely different space. You know, the fact that people can come in and be comfortable and hang out and eat and drink and just enjoy the space almost like a home, you know, almost mm-hmm. like, or, you know, that classic third space, that has made a huge, huge difference.
Right.
Yeah.
The name, Scuppernong.
Oh, right, of course.
How did you decide on that?
I tell you, it was this moment that was not great for my marriage. You know, Stacy, my wife, said, hey, how about Scuppernong? You know, because we're just searching desperately for a name. And of course, I dismiss it. You know, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. Scuppernong, you know, no way. And then a little while later, Greg, one of the original partners, said, hey, how about Scuppernong? And I said, oh.
And had you talked to Stacy?
No, I had not talked to Stacy. Okay. No, right. And so the second time hearing it rang a little differently. And I had to go back to Stacy and say, oh, all right, sorry. I was so dismissive. Yeah, that's the word that will work. Because we were looking for a North Carolina-specific name that didn't carry any, you know, baggage, you know.
Right.
Scuppernong is just a grape, kind of specific to North Carolina. The mother vine is this oldest continually producing grapevine in North America, I believe, right? And it's on the Roanoke Island. And it's, by the way, the state fruit. Scuppernong grapes had the state fruit. We didn't know it when we named the store, but it is indeed. And it's a good word, right? It's a very, very memorable word.
Very.
Hard to spell. I spent a lot of my life going S-C-U, you know, which gets old, but I'm happy with the name.
Poet, writer, and Scuppernong Books owner, Brian Lampkin. In celebration of Scuppernong's first year in business, they will be hosting a one-year anniversary party on Saturday, February 7th, from 6 to 10 p.m. The band Little Mountain will be entertaining guests. There will be book and drink specials and reflections on the bookstore's first year. For a look ahead at the event scheduled for the next few months, to find out more about the store's new membership program, and to learn about the staff at Scuppernong, visit our website at WFDD.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
All right, time to get to what else is going on in and around the Triad. So much stuff to do and so little time. But first, a news flash. I wanted to relay this to you guys first. We're an NPR News affiliate. We've got to get this done. NFL ear pressure culprit. Yeah. Has been apprehended by police. You know, the football scandal? Yeah. Evidently, it was an operatic rodent. His name, Deflator Mouse.
So,
cheesy, I know. Yes, but and thank you, Joe Pecoraro, for that great joke. But that is, and speaking of opera, my pick for this weekend does involve opera. I've always said this, that there are certain performers out there or ensembles that just transcend genre. I always throw out the example of Pavarotti as one of those, because you can hate opera. But I guarantee you, if you're sitting in front of Pavarotti, when he was singing at his peak, you're going to be sold on it. There's great performers can do that. And one of the ensembles that can do that is the Metropolitan Opera. And this weekend, you get a chance to hear The Met live in HD and experience it as if you were in that front row seat at the Metropolitan Opera in New York in real time, surrounded with your audience members who really appreciate opera. And instead of paying, you know, $5,000 for a front row seat at the Met, it's about $20 here in Winston-Salem at the Hanesbrands Theater. It's a really neat, intimate theater and a great experience. And that's coming up Saturday, January 31st at 12:55, live at the Met, Hanesbrands Theater at 209 Spruce Street. And if you've never experienced anything like that, you just blend in with the audience on stage at the Met. It's really a fun experience. Yeah, I recommend it.
That sounds great. And if you take David up on his recommendation, maybe you park downtown. And as you're walking to the theater, I want to suggest that you check out something that's going on in town. It's called Storefront Winston-Salem. It's the second series in a project that's put on by Associated Artists of Winston-Salem. And basically the goal is this group is commissioning artists to really get creative with some vacant or unused storefront window spaces.
That's a great idea.
It is. And, you know, I noticed this first when I was at Mooney's across the street. There is an installation that's done by the Winston-Salem Light Project. It's called Terra Luna. Really captivating, you know, suspended multicolored light bulbs, an illuminated moon in the background, sort of a toy rocket ship, and a light box at the bottom with the title of the piece. Other programs like this are going on around the country. There are things like this in Seattle and San Francisco and closer to us in Durham and Chapel Hill. And it's really helping to revitalize downtown, bringing more foot traffic to certain spaces and also helping those buildings that are up for rent or for lease. So I think it's a really cool project. And what's even better is that they are tying the pieces in with local themes. So right now, the theme is the intersection of art and science. Coming up around the time of River Run, it's going to be an homage to great films. And later on this summer, they're going to be inspired by the National Black Theater Festival that'll be going on in July and August. So we want to hear from you. How would you maybe design your own window? You can tell us on Facebook. And I think that's something really cool to check out. And not only check out now, but continue to watch in the future.
Great.
So Eddie, what about you? What do you have?
So this weekend in Greensboro at the Blind Tiger, Crystal Bright and the Silver Hands is playing a concert. Her latest record came out in, I believe, November. She was on Triad Arts, called The Absolute Elsewhere, and the album was inspired by a series of photographs, and it was a very collaborative experience. And for her record release in Carbo in the fall, she had lots of guests, but her shows in the Triad since then have been a regular Crystal Bright with her core band shows. Well, Saturday night, January 31st at the Blind Tiger, she's having this huge release for Greensboro. It's a multimedia collaboration with the photography company who did all the portraits and all the photographs that inspired the record. There's going to be aerial dancing, acrobatics, LED hooping, which I've never seen before. Sounds fun. Juggling, miming, and all other kinds of dance performances with a huge list, including Jacob Felder, who's been on Triad Arts before, and Madeline Greco. They've both been on here in the past. Opening acts are Chris Bathgate and Molly Sullivan. And also they're going to be filming the performance. And Crystal Bright is encouraging audience members to take pictures and videos during the event to possibly wind up in the final film. So it's a concert where the performers encourage you to please take out your phones during the concert.
Oh, I'd love to see the finished product with that. That's a great idea. All the different camera angles you get with people in the audience.
And the series of photography, I've seen that. I think we posted some on our website before. Yeah. We can post a few more. It's beautiful. Those images are really stunning and gorgeous.
Yeah, then I think she might be premiering a video as well, but don't hold me to it.
I won't.
Great. Lots to do. Go out and get them. Support the local art scene here in the Triad.
That's our show for today. I'm Associate Producer Bethany Chafin. Our Executive Producer is David Ford, and our Technical Producer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to all of our guests and events and more on our website at WFDD.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm Bethany Chafin. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.